In Galatians chapter 6, Paul is dealing with the last things that he really wants to say to them. And it's pretty clear to me in verses 11 through 16 that he's basically rehashing what he said in his letter. And he's doing it in a little bit different way, because verse 11, the affirmation that this letter actually came from Paul's hand, because his writing with large letters was one of the things that he did to make sure that people weren't being deceived by letters that were spurious. That's a very obvious throwback to chapters 1 and 2, because the issue of the large letters is, did this come from Paul? And the issue of did it come from Paul is, why does that matter? Because he's an apostle. He speaks for God. If it came from Paul, it came from God. That's verse 11. And then verses 12 and 13, which is what we're going to look at this afternoon, these two verses are a restatement of the issue that was being dealt with as the false brethren were proclaiming a different message. The issue of whether and why you can't trust them. Not only is Paul a legitimate apostle, but they're not even legitimate brethren. They're false. And when you read verses 12 and 13, you get the impression that Paul is dealing with their motives. They desire to make a good showing so that they won't be persecuted. They who are circumcised don't even keep the law, but they desire to have you circumcised so that can boast in your flesh. These are motive issues. And in Paul's own instructions, he often challenged his readers not to jump into the area of motives. Don't go there, he said, especially to the Corinthians. Until everything that's hidden is brought to light, don't go there. Because motives are a hard thing to decide, to determine. Sometimes the same kind of behavior can be driven by a totally different motivation. So it's a little bit interesting that he would... This is what we would typically call an ad hominem argument, isn't it? Attacking the person. Saying, you can't trust them because their motives are bad. Well, in this case, it's inspired by the Holy Spirit. So we have to assume that's a legitimate thing. But what we want to do is look at the thing that he's actually accusing them of. He says they want to make a good showing in verse 12. And the reason for that is so they won't be persecuted. And in verse 13, they desire you to be circumcised, but they don't even keep the law. They only want that so they can boast or glory in your flesh. Why is he saying these things? Well, partly to expose their theology as a false thing. When we really want to get down to the nitty-gritty of something physical, we go for a microscope. You can take a microscope and you can put a slide under the lens, and then you can narrow your focus of attention and adjust until you can see this. And all the time you're concentrated on this reality, all this stuff out here to making difference. And in a sense, that's the kind of approach we have to take to the Word of God. When God says something, we need to be able to pull our attention down to what he said and why he said it and what it means and how it applies. And we need to ignore all this stuff out here. It's very hard to get people to do that. And that's why I think Paul is doing what he's doing in verses 12 and 13. He's making one final attempt to get the people in Galatia to not pay attention to the false teaching that has been introduced there. So, we're going to approach this issue under the thesis that motive is a huge issue. And in the Bible, the word agape is your motive word. And the issue of agape is what is important, what is valuable. And then the other word of the scriptures, pistis, faith, that raised the question, what's true? So what's valuable and what's true? Those are the two biggest theses of the Bible. If something's important, then you need a method for chasing it. The value is established by agape, and the methodology is established by faith. So, under that idea, that motive is crucial and method is crucial, we're going to see that Paul is doubling down in verses 12 and 13 on the false brethren's motives and their truth construct. They're compelling others, particularly Gentiles, to be circumcised in order to be able to have a right relationship with God. That's called a truth construct. Is it true? Do you have to be circumcised to have a right relationship with God if you're a man? That's what they're saying. Paul wants to challenge that big time, and he does. So we're going to look at the motives that they have for their actions and the truth that they're setting forth, or the claim to truth that they're setting forth. So we're going to look at Paul's expose of the false brethren's loves to start with. In the two verses of 12 and 13, Paul uses the word desire both places. Those who desire to make a good showing, they desire to have you circumcised. Those are the things they want. But he says they want this in this light. Verse 12, they want to make a good showing in the flesh. The word that's translated make a good showing is a significant issue in light of the way Paul uses it. And he's the only author in the New Testament ever used it, and it's the only place he uses it. So it's a one-time use in the whole New Testament. And anytime that happens, you have to ask yourself, why would Paul choose a word like that when there are words that you can use that are better known, maybe? So let's just think about these motives. In the first place, in John 5:44, Jesus asked the Pharisees, how can you believe who receive glory from men and don't seek the glory that comes only from God? And that statement, how can you believe, is a question when Jesus raised it, but it's actually a theological principle. That if your impression, if you desire to impress men, you cannot be exercising faith. You can't even come up with faith when your motive is so off target. And trying to be impressive to men is simply not from God, period. In the first place, Paul said in Galatians 2 that those who appeared to be somewhat, and then he sticks in this parenthesis, what they seem to be, any difference to me, God's not a respecter of persons. I mean, he said that in chapter 2 about James and John and Peter. And what he's saying is God's not impressed by men, and it's not a part of his way of our relating to one another for us to try to be impressive to one another. That's just completely off the wall. It's absolutely not legitimate. It will kill our ability to walk by faith, because a faith walk means that you're trying to believe things to accomplish things that are within the will of God. And it is never within the will of God for you to try to be impressive to others. So the question is, why would Paul use this make a good showing term? Well, it's actually a word that was coined to be kind of like putting on a good face. In fact, the word face and good is both there. Put on your impressive face. The reason why we put on our makeup and stuff, isn't it, ladies? Before we go to work. It's why we fix ourselves up so that we'll look decent or whatever. But more times than not, decent's not the issue. It's impressive. We want to be impressive in some sense. Well, Paul's declaration is that this is a false objective. It includes two things. One of them is the idea of a good showing, so that the element in the word good is to be well received. I want to look like this so that other people will see and receive me, that they won't reject me. Now, in our culture, we went from one extreme to the other, and just maybe my generation. There was a time when appearance was everything, and then there was a time when grunge was everything, and appearance didn't make a difference at all, period, none. The uglier you could be, the nastier you could be, the dirtier you could be, the better you were all. But even that was, in a very real sense, an attempt to be impressive to a certain group of people. So it's always, you know, this appearance thing is always in light of a group of people that you want to fit into, that you want them to receive you, you want them to be accepting to you. And that was part of what drove Paul's request for God to fix his eye problem, because he felt like that it was repulsive to people. He said that to the Galatians. You could have rejected me from the awfulness of my appearance, but instead you received me as an angel from God. Well, if you can be received as an angel from God looking as bad as Paul looked, well, then you don't have to worry about your looks, right? So that's the idea. Paul recognized that the whole issue of wanting to be accepted and appreciated and received by others is a secondary and maybe even a false desire. Because we're only supposed to be concerned about one person's opinion of us in this world, this universe, and that's God. And the thing about God's good impression, if He has a good impression, if He receives you, then He makes it possible for you to be received by others who are received by Him. In other words, He creates a group of people who will receive you regardless of what you look like, because He's received you and they will too. But by the same token, those that He receives are typically rejected by those that He doesn't. And because of that, Ishmael persecuted Isaac. That whole notion, there's conflict there. So the deal of making a good showing so that they won't be persecuted at the end of the verse is very clearly taught in the Scriptures. That if you're well received by God, you will be persecuted by those that are not. And of course, not too many weeks ago, we looked at the fact that it's not legitimate for people who are received by God to reject or to persecute those that are not. Those that are not have never felt any restraint against persecuting those who are. So that's the kind of thing that's going on here. And what he's doing is he's talking about putting on a show. And he categorically places that in the realm of the flesh. Partly because that's basically the only way you can make a show. It's got to be a physical demonstration of some kind. You're not going to be impressive without a body expressing certain things to try to make other people be impressed. So, in the flesh is almost necessary. If you're going to try to make a good show, it has to be in the flesh. But Paul's term in the flesh had to do with in the realm, where fleshliness is a fundamentally bad thing, because in the flesh is a characteristic of those whose antagonism toward God sets them up on a whole different agenda. And in that agenda area, where Paul was for 33 years of his life, or at least the early part of his life, was all about creating a show to try to be impressive, to try to be exalted by the others. But he says that this issue is so that they won't be persecuted. Now, the question that has to come up is, why would you automatically be persecuted if you didn't make a good showing in the flesh? Well, he says it'll be because of the cross of Christ. But there are an awful lot of people that subscribe to the cross of Christ who still are desperately trying to make a good showing so they won't be persecuted. Now, how do you separate that out? Well, there's only one way you can. It's like the false brethren in Jerusalem. Did they claim that Jesus was the Christ? Yeah. Did they claim that He was crucified by the Romans? Yeah. Did they believe that He was raised from the dead? Yeah. They were members of the visible group in Jerusalem that believed all those things. But Paul calls them false brethren. On what basis? That they didn't believe that Jesus was the Christ? No. On the basis of how you attach that to the reason why He died. See, there are a lot of people that say Jesus was crucified to make it possible for you to start doing the right kinds of things so that God would accept you on the basis of what you do. Well, that's a perversion of the cross. The cross's definitive statement is you cannot do sufficiently to impress God. You cannot. Jesus wouldn't have had to die if He could. So the cross is basically a statement. The biblical concept of the cross is biblically a statement that men are hopelessly incapable. And that is such an insult to the spirit of man that there are just an awful lot of people that will not take that. And they will persecute anybody that promotes it. And false teachers know that. They know Ishmael persecuted Isaac. They know that the persecution has always been a characteristic of the methodology of those who are opposed to those that don't agree with them. And they participate in what Paul was doing as a Pharisee. But these guys, they don't want to pay the price of being identified with the cross, because that's not impressive. They don't want to pay the price. But what does that mean? Bottom line, it means they don't want to suffer anything physically or emotionally or spiritually for the truth's sake. They don't want to. I want my life to be pleasant, comfortable, and easy, and that's the way I want it. So, what Paul is saying in verse 12 is, you can't trust these guys because their motivation is completely wrong. They want to make a good showing in the flesh. So, if you run into people who are obviously trying to make a good showing in the flesh, you can't trust them. Doesn't matter what they say with their mouths. You can't trust them. That's what he's saying. And then in verse 13, he also says that they do what they do at the end of the verse so that they can boast in your flesh. Well, what does that mean? How could you get the basis for boasting in the flesh of other, particularly men, who are being circumcised under your insistence? How does that work? Well, just like all the religious success stories work. How many times have you heard a noted evangelist say, we had evangelistic services and X number of people came to Jesus? Well, that can be a positive testimony, but also can be called bragging. And the question is, glorying in somebody else's flesh means, bottom line, you should be looked up to because you have all these people who are willing to follow your leadership. That's what these guys are looking for. They want to compel people to be circumcised so that they can then point to them as their disciples. See how impressive we are with our doctrine and our methods and all that? These are the people who validate us as being who we claim we are. That's called glorying in your flesh. It's completely illegitimate. It's not wrong to rejoice in the things that God does. It's not wrong to even tell people things that God has done in respect to the things that you've preached and taught or whatever you've done. I mean, Paul went back and made reports to the church. But it's hugely wrong when your whole reason for doing it is so that you'll look really good. It's hugely wrong. It's totally wrong, and it drives bad doctrine. And let's just look at how bad the doctrine is. In verse 12 and at the end of verse 13, Paul has indulged in what we call the ad hominem concept, where you attack the person. You say, he's not trustworthy, he's bad, he's rotten, he's, you know, you don't want to follow him because he's a bad person. That's the ad hominem thing. If they can't reject the facts, they'll reject the individual making all kinds of accusations. Well, Paul is not into that, because he's already shown their doctrine's corrupt, chapters 3 and 4. This is now getting personal, because he wants them to understand that a false brother always has bad motives and he is always untrustworthy. Why so? The proof. Verse 13. Those who are circumcised do not even keep the law themselves. Now, how hypocritical can you get? You got to do this in order for God to accept you. Well, did you do it? Yeah. Well, is that the only thing God says to do? No. Do you do all the other stuff he says to do? Well, nobody's perfect. The issue is that Paul is trying to say, look, any doctrinal basis that requires you to do something by the person that's preaching it, but he himself doesn't practice the thing himself, there's got to be something wrong. You say, well, but these guys that are preaching circumcision, they've been circumcised. Well, technically, yeah, because their dads had it done to them when they were 8 days old. I mean, they didn't do anything for themselves, to themselves. But the issue is not actual circumcision. Circumcision for Paul is an umbrella word. It means keeping the law. That's what he says. They don't keep the law. Circumcision is a one-word summary concept for keeping the law of God. So when somebody says, you have to be circumcised, what they actually mean is, you have to keep the law. Or what? Or God won't accept you. Well, then God's not going to be accepting anybody. Because there isn't a person on the planet that keeps the law. Because the issue of keeping the law is not occasionally doing what it says. The issue of keeping the law is consistently doing everything it says all the time. That's what consistently means, all the time. And even the most blind, arrogant Pharisee on the planet would not actually argue that he never dropped the ball. I mean, well, nobody's perfect. You can't expect perfection. Well, Paul's not expecting perfection here, but he's saying they are. They're teaching it, but they're not doing it. If they teach it but don't do it, then you've got to know their theology is wrong. You've got to know that. If you can't live up to the issues of your own preaching, then your preaching's flawed. That's the reason why Paul started out there in Galatians 2 by saying, I've been crucified with Christ, nevertheless I live, yet not I, but Christ lives in me, and the life that I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith of the Son of God. In other words, he's not claiming that he's perfect. He's not claiming that his theology will bring about perfection. What he is claiming is that because Christ died for us as sinners, we can be accepted before God as sinful people. We can be accepted by him, forgiven and redeemed and regenerated. But even in our regeneration, we don't claim that we're the ones who are doing all the stuff. Our regeneration consists of having the Spirit of Jesus come into our physical bodies to provide a whole different foundation for living. And when good comes out of these bodies, it is Jesus in there producing it out of there. And that means I can't glory in it. I can't claim it as my production. I can't say, look at me. And Paul never did that. But that's his accusation here in verse 13. The proof that their doctrine, the proof that the whole idea that you can be accepted by God on the basis of what you do, the proof of that is nobody does it. Nobody does it. So, if nobody does it, then nobody can be accepted by God. Oh, but you can be accepted by God if you do this. Nobody does it. Nobody can be accepted. And that's the issue. So that's what he's doing in verses 12 and 13. He's just driving toward the whole idea that you got to decide who you're going to trust. And in Galatians, who you're going to trust is Paul or his opponents, because those are the two guys that are the doctrinal producers. And Paul says, okay, I've given you the reasons for believing me, and now I'm telling you the reasons why you can't believe them. And yet there is one more element to that, and that is the issue of how honestly does, well, they can't honestly do it, but how does a Pharisee or a legalist handle Paul's accusation? You guys don't even do what you're insisting other people do. How do they handle that? Well, yeah, we do. God, nobody's perfect. Everybody knows that. But God doesn't require perfection. I mean, did y'all know that purgatory is not a Catholic doctrine first? Catholics didn't come up with purgatory. You know who did? The Jews. It was a Jewish doctrine before it was a Catholic doctrine. What does the doctrine of purgatory mean?
Some place you go between the dying and your final heaven to kind of take things off.
Yeah, you purge yourself. That's purgatory. You purge yourself of all of your failures in this life by suffering sufficiently to eliminate things. So, for example, if you tell a lie, then God assigns you X number of hours or days or weeks or months out, and they can't tell you how much. But God assigns a certain amount of punishment for you in purgatory. And once you've suffered through these assigned hours of thing, then that little lie or whatever is erased. And then he goes to the next thing that you did wrong. And that's why Tesla and those guys were trying to sell indulgences worth millions of years off of purgatory. Because, quite frankly, if you live 70 years in this world and you got to suffer a certain amount of time for everything that you've done wrong, you're going to be suffering a long, 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 long time. But what's the whole point of purgatory? Two things. The cross of Christ did not deal with that, and your suffering can erase your guilt. Well, both of them are wrong. The Catholic doctrine is the reason you go to purgatory is because Christ only died for your connection to Adam. When you are regenerated, your connection to Adam is broken. But at that point, your life is yours to live, and you will suffer in purgatory for every mistake you make. That's the doctrine. So the cross of Christ wasn't about your life. It was about being separated from Adam. And then the whole idea that you can actually suffer a certain finite period of time to erase a sin against an infant God is just absolutely ridiculous. How much pain did you inflict in the infinite God when you did this thing? Well, that's how much you're going to have to suffer before that can be erased. Well, He's infinite. You've got to suffer. And that's just for one sin. How many have you committed? There's no way. So what do? Well, they come up with what I call squish theology. It's real squishy. They divide sins into the bad ones and the not so bad ones. In Catholic terminology, it's the mortal and the venial. What's a mortal sin in Catholic theology? Mortal sin is one that sends you to hell. What's a venial sin? All the other kind. That doesn't send you to hell. And they would call, for example, murdering somebody and dying without confession of a priest, without the last rites, they would call that a mortal sin. If you, for example, if you commit suicide, and before you actually expire, a priest doesn't come, you don't confess, and you aren't given the last, you can go to hell, because that's a mortal sin. A venial sin is pretty much any kind of sin you do, as long as you can get the confession or get the last rites. The concept of excommunication in the Catholic Church is you can't receive the sacraments and be given grace by God if you're blocked from the church. So you better behave or we'll block you from the church. And then all your sins will be mortal. This is the theology of legalism. Dividing sins up so that some are really bad and some are not so bad. The ones that are really bad will actually send you to hell, but the majority of them are not that quite that bad. And isn't that the way it works? Aren't almost every group of that teach legal theology, where you have to do certain things in order to be acceptable before God, they've got it down to 5 or 6 or 7 things. If you do these, you're fine. Well, life's filled with a whole lot more than those 5 or 6 or 7 things. What about all the rest of that? That's Paul's argument. You go straight from the reality of the necessity for God's justice to be completely removed from you. That's the death of Jesus on your behalf. You go from that to some kind of a squishy thing where the justice of God kind of sort of still stays on top of you and you know, you either behave or you don't, and you go to purgatory if you don't, and on and on and on and on and on. It's just real squishy. Paul's doctrine was, no. Jesus Christ died on the cross to remove the justice of God completely out of the picture as far as you're concerned with God. He'll never visit justice upon you. There is no condemnation to you in Christ.